Golden State Media Concepts bring you the Bible Study Podcast. Reflect and journey the Bible as together we study God's Word and be inspired. Bible study made fun and informative for all ages. It's the Golden State Media Concepts Bible Study Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the GSMC Bible Study Podcast, brought to you by the GSMC Podcast Network. I am your host, Sarah, and today we will be concluding the episode that we started on Sunday, where we were talking about the text assigned for this week, the week of February 4th, the week of the fifth Sunday after Epiphany. We talked about the Old Testament texts on Sunday, the texts from Isaiah and Psalm 147, Isaiah 40, and Psalm 147. And now today we'll move on to the New Testament text from 1 Corinthians and the Gospel of Mark. Advent, as you may remember, starts a new church year. And so when we start a new church year, we also start a new year in the lectionary cycle, which means that we begin reading from another of the three synoptic gospels as our main gospel for the year, with some supplementary readings always from the Gospel of John. And so now that we have started a new church year, we've moved into the Gospel of Mark. So we are in the Markan lectionary cycle, and you'll be hearing a lot of gospels readings from the book of Mark, of course. So I hope you are having a good week. It is Wednesday, which is well, you know, always kind of nice when you hit the middle of the week and you're kind of on that downhill slide. Then once you hit noon, or, you know, depending on your work schedule, we are a week away from the season of Lent. Next Wednesday is Ash Wednesday. It's also Valentine's Day. This year is very confused in its dates because Ash Wednesday this year is on Valentine's Day, which is kind of funny for people who may or may not be giving up chocolate for Lent. You won't be able to have your Valentine's chocolate unless you eat it early. And then Easter Sunday is also on April Fool's Day. How weird is that? April Fool's Day also happens to be my older brother's birthday. So it's the first time in his life, and he will be, how old am I? He will be 47 this year. He'll be 47, and it's the first time in his life that Easter has fallen on his birthday. I'm an April birthday baby also, and I've had it fall on my birthday twice. But first time on April Fool's Day in his 47 years. So at any rate, it's kind of interesting that both Ash Wednesday and Easter fall on those two dates this year. But enough of that. Let's turn to the text for today, the New Testament text. The first text we'll be looking at is from the book of 1 Corinthians. And it is 1 Corinthians 9, verses 16 through 23. And those verses are as follows. If I proclaim the gospel, this gives me no ground for boasting, for an obligation is laid on me, and woe to me if I do not proclaim the gospel. For if I do this of my own will, I have a reward, but if not of my own will, I am entrusted with a commission. What then is my reward? Just this, that in my proclamation I may make the gospel free of charge, so as not to make full use of my rights in the gospel. For though I am free with respect to all, I have made myself a slave to all, so that I might win more of them. To the Jews I became a Jew in order to win Jews. To those under the law I became as one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law I became as one outside the law, though I am not free from God's law, but am under Christ's law, so that I might win those outside the law. To the weak I became weak, so that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all people, that I might by all means save some. I do it all for the sake of the gospel, so that I may share in its blessings. Again, that is the reading from 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 16 through 23. And, oh, this text, first of all, is a bit of a tongue twister because it's so repetitive. But it always gives me pause when I read this text because I read it, of course, from my own context, which, you know, is how we often tend to read Bible verses. And when I get to that verse that says, I become all things to all people, that I might by all means save some, it gives me pause, because I think it just feels like it's setting up such unrealistic expectations. I have become all things to all people, that I might by all means save some. And I think sometimes congregations expect this from their pastors, and I think some pastors feel like they need to do this in order to be effective. They need to be all things to all people. And some congregations, I'm not saying all, and I'm not saying everybody in every congregation, but sometimes we place unrealistic expectations on our pastor, right? And sometimes our pastor does the same thing because of their own desire to succeed, their own desire to help those around them, but maybe also because of this text. Paul writes, I have become all things to all people. And this verse always jumps out at me and gives me pause. And so I was pleased to read a commentary this week from a woman named Carla Works. I don't know where Meeks came from. Carla Works, who is the associate professor in New Testament at Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. And she addresses this very sense of uncomfortableness that I feel when I read this text. She says, what are we willing to do so that others can see God? And she says exactly what I'm feeling. Taken out of context, today's epistle reading may sound a bit off-putting. Yes, Carla, thank you. Thank you for expressing exactly what's always been in my head. And then she quotes, you know, to the Jew, I became as a Jew, etc., etc. And she says that Paul's chameleon-like behavior seems to be changing based on whomever he is around at the time. To our 21st century ears, this may ring inauthentic. A mere sycophantic way to appease people. Ripped out of context, this passage could be dangerous, especially to those prone to be people pleasers already. But, she writes, is Paul really advocating inauthenticity or pleasing others for one's own sake? Perhaps there is more to this passage than initially meets the eye. Isn't there always, right? It's always the texts that make me feel the most uncomfortable or the ones that give me that moment of pause. And I've said this before, that because they give me that moment of pause, I want to look into them a little bit more. I want to find something just a little bit different to take away from that text, to see what someone else has to say, so that it's not just me putting my own spin on the text. And so she goes on to say that the context is the argument surrounding the consumption of idol food, not idol as in I-D-L-E, but idol, I-D-O-L, an issue first raised in the previous chapter. So Paul is continuing the conversation, of course. These verses don't just come on their own. They are in the context of the entire epistle. So she goes on to say, since few people had homes large enough to host a party, banquets were often held at the local temple, which had plenty of dining rooms to use for such an occasion. But eating within the temple precinct meant that not only was one consuming idol, I-D-O-L, food, but also participating in rituals that honored the gods. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you can see where this would be an issue for early Christians, right? That they're trying to live within this new church that has been created. They are trying to live according to the teachings that they have been given, but this becomes kind of a social matter and kind of a matter of logistics. If you need to host a banquet or a large gathering, most homes, of course, weren't big enough. So you have to use what's available to you. But that puts you in a position where you might be eating food that you shouldn't be eating. You might be participating in rituals that you have said you wouldn't participate in because you are now a part of this new church and you have come to believe in God, in Christ, etc. So this congregation, the congregation in Corinth, is divided on whether to eat this food, this idol food. Some in the congregation are claiming that it's perfectly acceptable to dine at the local temple, even though all food at the local temple would technically, of course, be idol food. That is, food that had first been offered in celebration and honor to the patron deity of the temple. Now, I do want to just jump in with my own opinion here that I do like this sense of recycling, that the food has been dedicated in honor and celebration of a particular deity, but then it doesn't just go to waste. People in the community get to eat that food. So I do appreciate that aspect of this. But of course, for the Christians at this time, the idol means nothing because, and this is the argument of the people who are claiming that it's okay to eat at the temple, the idol means nothing because they affirm that there is only one God and, of course, one Lord. So they say this knowledge means that they can go through the motions of the ritual without really honoring the idols as gods. That's one side of the story, one side of the argument. The other side of the argument is others, however, she says, are witnessing the behavior of the knowledgeable ones and thinking that it is acceptable to honor the other deities alongside Christ. For them, whom the know-it-alls have called weak, the idols still exist and the rituals have power. They question whether participation in religious ceremonies means that it is acceptable to worship other gods alongside the God that they have come to know through the teachings of Christ. So she says, to relate this dilemma to a context that we can understand, many people pray before a meal, right? To some, that prayer may seem perfunctory, it may seem just a ritual. But to others, at that same meal, that prayer may be deeply meaningful. She says, nonetheless, the words of the prayer give thanks to God. Does participation in the prayer necessarily mean that one is acknowledging that there is a God who is worthy of thanksgiving? Can one participate in religious rites out of respect without believing the words that are being spoken? She goes on to say, to consider the Corinthians' context, what about those who used to believe in other gods and return to their former religious practices based on the example of others in the church? How does participation in the rites of the local temple affect one's witness to the God of Israel, who is a jealous God? These are the questions at the heart of the debate at this church in Corinth. So here is the context. Here is the background for why we are reading this text from Paul, why he is now saying he has become all things to all people. Because they're having this argument. They're having this maybe crisis of conscience. What does it mean to eat this food that has been dedicated to other small g gods, right? What does it mean? Does it mean that they are honoring those gods? Does it mean that the vows that they have made, the conversion that they had in order to hear the words of Christ, believe in the words of Christ, become children of God, is that negated? What does it all mean? So Paul wants the Corinthians, and she says particularly the know-it-alls who have social status, to consider their brothers and sisters in Christ and to be willing to renounce their rights, status, and privilege when necessary. It may be permissible for them to attend the banquet, but it is not beneficial to the good of the community. In 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 1 through 27, before the verses that we read today, Paul talks about his own practice as one who has authority as an apostle to receive financial support from the church, but who willingly renounces that right to bring the gospel free of charge. So that might make a little more sense as to why he starts this particular text starts with the way he says it, when he's talking about why he proclaims the gospel and what that means. So he has willingly renounced that financial support to bring the gospel free of charge. He would rather take up labor, even labor that the Corinthians might consider or think of as demeaning, than to take their money. And what goes unsaid in this passage, she says, is the etiquette of patronage. She says to accept the money of those of social status would make it impossible for him to correct their behavior. He cannot be indebted to them. Rather, in our text for today, he speaks of his debt to the gospel. He owes his life and his existence to God. So it's one of those things, you know, you've heard that phrase, there's no such thing as a free lunch, whether you believe that to be true or not. Paul doesn't want to have mixed emotions, he doesn't want to have blurred boundaries. Maybe that's a good way to look at it. So if he takes money from the church to do what he's doing, then he may feel like he is indebted to them because of their patronage. And he doesn't want to be that way because then he might feel that he can't speak as freely to them as he might want to. So he would rather do other work outside his work in the gospel, his work as a pastor, to earn his living and keep himself without conflict. So he doesn't have these dual boundaries. He doesn't have these conflicts of interest. We are going to talk a little bit more about this text from 1 Corinthians and then move on to the gospel reading for today, but we are going to take our first break of the podcast. So when we come back, we'll finish talking about this text and then move on to the gospel from Mark. Stay tuned. You're listening to the GSMC Bible Study Podcast, and I will be right back.
Want to find out what movies to go see? Then check out the GSMC Movie Podcast. It's your ticket to the latest movies, whether it's a new blockbuster event, romantic, comedy, or action flick. This show has got it all covered. They talk some what to go see now. Don't bother. What's hot on Netflix and everything in between? That's GSMCpodcast.com/movie-podcast. When it's all about the movies, it has to be this new show. Don't forget to like them on Facebook and follow them on Twitter. Visit GSMCpodcast.com for more info.
Welcome back to the GSMC Bible Study Podcast. We are talking about the text from 1 Corinthians and this idea that Paul talks about becoming all things to all people and what that might mean. And we've been looking at this commentary from Carla Works, and she's talking about the context of this reading and looking at it within the larger context of the letter as a whole. And she says that, of course, there is this debate going on about whether or not it's acceptable to eat food that is in the temple that has been dedicated to other gods. And the know-it-alls, or those, she refers to them as the know-it-alls, the people maybe with status, are saying it's not a big deal. We can do this, and it's not backsliding. We're not going back to our old ways. But what about people who might not be as strong in their faith or who might not have that status? What about those? And so she's then talking about how Paul does not, he works outside of his work of the gospel to make his money to live on rather than being indebted to the church so that he can have these difficult conversations. She says this sense of compulsion and indebtedness leads him, Paul, to be a servant, not just to his own people, but to the nations. In 1 Corinthians 9:22, he connects his argument explicitly to the language that the know-it-alls are using. To the weak, I became weak, that I might win the weak. No one in the Roman world strives to appear weak. Weakness is not a virtue in this society. Paul is asking those with power and status to come alongside those whom they deem weak, those who might not be as strong in their faith or their social status as they are. And consider this situation, consider this argument through another perspective. She says, after all, Christ died for this so-called weak one. Jesus' voluntary self-lowering is the paradigm that shapes Paul's instruction. She writes, seeking the advantage of another rather than one's own advantage, however, would not have been a popular message in this church in Corinth. Paul's advice would have social repercussions. For instance, how many times can one decline a dinner invitation when the host is a business partner? If one's attendance at that banquet, however, is destroying a brother or sister, is the status gained by the meal really worth it? Social privileges come at a cost. Paul, she says, is convinced that the gospel turns this world of privilege upside down. So, she says, in this season of Epiphany, what might those of us with privilege need to relinquish so that others can see the love of God? What are those things in our lives that we say, oh, it's no big deal? Do you ever have conversations with your friends about whatever it might be that they're struggling with? And this can be any number of things. And you find yourself saying, it's not that big of a deal. Just don't do it. You know, just don't think about it. Just don't engage in that activity, whatever it might be. Well, you are speaking from a place of certain privilege. Let's say it's alcohol. Well, just don't drink. Well, if you're an alcoholic, that's a lot more difficult than if you're not an alcoholic. If you know someone who is going through a time of depression or other mental illness, I hear people say all the time, well, just think happy thoughts. Well, that comes from a place where you don't have the chemical imbalance in your brain. So you come from a different place. It could be considered a place of privilege. We have to consider the context of those to whom we are speaking. And when we say, well, just don't do that, or just do this, or just think the way I think, you'll be fine. That is coming from a place of privilege. So what do we need to relinquish so that others can see the love of God? I think this is a great question for you to take into your week, especially this week as we are going into the season of Lent. What do you need to relinquish so that others can see the love of God? And, you know, Lent is a time often of fasting or of taking on a spiritual practice. So do you need to relinquish chocolate so that others might see the love of God? I'm not saying that giving up chocolate is bad. I'm not going to chastise anyone for what they choose to give up for Lent. I myself have given up chocolate many years. But is there something in your life that you could do differently so that others can see God's love in you? Can you speak differently? Can you perceive differently? And this doesn't mean becoming all things to all people. This doesn't mean becoming a people pleaser. This means what Paul is doing, trying to see from another's perspective so that they are then better able to hear the word of God or to see God's love through you. You put yourself a little bit in their place, or, you know, it's empathy. It doesn't mean you're changing your entire personality. It doesn't mean that you are becoming someone new or becoming something new because of the people around you. It simply means, can you understand their perspective? Can you step into their shoes for a while? Can you walk their path to see what they see? And how does that change how you interact with them? How does that change how you speak to them? When you speak to them differently because of this empathy, because you have seen the path that they are walking, will they see you differently? Will they see God through you because you have met them where they're at? None of us can be all things to all people. It's just not possible. It's just an exercise in crazy making, frankly. It's not going to happen. But we can empathize with people that we don't necessarily understand. Rather than just dismissing someone's concerns outright, like this argument going on about whether it's acceptable to eat in the temple and eat food that has been dedicated as idols. Oh, pff, it's not a big deal. Just do it. You know, we do it all the time. It's just food, and we're secure in our faith. We know which God we worship. We know we worship the one God. Well, what about someone who is newer to their faith, who isn't as secure in their faith? That is not taking that perspective into account. So what happens when you take another's perspective into account, when you really truly listen to their fears and their concerns, what happens to the conversation when you both do that, when both sides try to see from the other? And I really am liking this commentary because it helps me to see this, this set of verses from Paul in a slightly different light in terms of communication, in terms of how we deal with conflict in our communities. Paul, first and foremost, was a pastor. As much as he drives me crazy in the way that he writes sometimes, as much as I want to reach in the pages and shake him because of what he writes and then how that can often be taken out of context to judge people, it's not always necessarily Paul's fault, the way we use his words, but I have a lot of issues with Paul, but I also often find myself thinking, realizing that he really truly was a pastor who was just trying to help the communities with whom he was working, the communities to whom he was ministering. He wrote these letters because he saw issues in the congregations that he wanted to help address. He wanted to help them grow and thrive as churches because, of course, it was a new community. It was a new church. It was a new way of looking at the world through these promises of God, that God made through Christ. This was all completely new, and people were still trying to find their way. So Paul is helping this congregation find their way. He is helping them to see things in a slightly different light, to try to see the other side of the argument. And we could benefit from that as well, I think, because we live in a world that's increasingly polarized for a variety of reasons. I'm not going to try to unpack all of that as to why the world is so polarized, but it feels like there's not much middle ground on a lot of things anymore. You're either here or you're there. You're either black or you're white in terms of your thinking. You're either, you know, there's no gray area. You're either yes or no. And there just doesn't seem to be a lot of middle ground. But what if we put our own ego aside a little bit? You know, you could say to the Republicans, I became a Republican. To the Democrats, I became a Democrat. This might be highly uncomfortable to some people. But what if we did that to, you know, you could put that, I just chose those labels because they are, you know, two different things that often are diametrically opposed. But it's not just politics. There are labels that we could use for any number of arguments that people are polarized on. You can put those to this group. I became as that group because when I did that, I was able to see how they viewed the world. I was able to see what they were seeing, what they were struggling with. And maybe I didn't come to their way of thinking, but I realized where they were coming from. And then maybe you're able to see God in each other when you stop just putting your own opinion out there and the other side just puts their opinion out there, when you really stop to listen to one another. So we are going to take our second break of the podcast, and when we come back, we'll be moving on to the gospel reading from Mark. You are listening to the GSMC Bible Study Podcast, and we will be right back.
Tired of searching the vast jungle of podcasts? Now listen close and hear this out. There's a podcast network that covers just about everything that you've been searching.
Hey!
The Golden State Media Concepts Podcast Network is here. Nothing less than a podcast bliss with endless hours of podcast coverage. From news, sports, music, fashion, cooking, entertainment, fantasy, football, and so much more. So stop lurking around and go straight out to the Golden State Media Concepts Podcast Network. Guaranteed to fill that podcast itch, whatever it may be. Visit us at www.gsmcpodcast.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and download us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Google Play.
Thank you. Welcome back to the GSMC Bible Study Podcast. We are about to conclude the four readings assigned for this week, the week of February 4th, the fifth Sunday after Epiphany. We have covered the Isaiah reading from chapter 40. We have talked about Psalm 147. We just finished speaking about 1 Corinthians chapter 9. And now we move on to the Gospel of Mark. And the Gospel for this week comes from the Gospel of Mark, chapter 1, verses 29 through 39, and those verses are as follows. As soon as they left the synagogue, they entered the house of Simon and Andrew, with James and John. Now Simon's mother-in-law was in bed with a fever, and they told Jesus about her at once. Jesus came and took her by the hand and lifted her up. Then the fever left her, and she began to serve them. That evening at sundown, they brought to him all who were sick or possessed with demons. And the whole city was gathered around the door, and Jesus cured many who were sick with various diseases, and cast out many demons, and he would not permit the demons to speak, because they knew him. In the morning, while it was still very dark, he got up and went out to a deserted place, and there he prayed. And Simon and his companions hunted for him. When they found him, they said to him, "Everyone is searching for you." Jesus answered, "Let us go on to the neighboring towns, so that I may proclaim the message there also, for that is what I came out to do." And he went through Galilee, proclaiming the message in their synagogues and casting out demons. Again, that is the Gospel of Mark, chapter 1, verses 29 through 39. And the first thing that I think of when I read this text is, Jesus was an introvert. That's not necessarily true, but as an introvert, I read part of this text, the part where after he's been preaching and teaching, and then he heals Simon's mother-in-law and continues to teach and preach and casts out demons, he goes to a deserted place where he can be alone and he can pray and just kind of rejuvenate himself. And that is definitely an introverted trait. I'm not saying that extroverts don't need some of that time to rejuvenate as well, but introverts like to go to their quiet place where they can just revitalize their spirit before they go back out into the world. And so, you know, Jesus may or may not have been an introvert, but to me, that gives me, that just, it's just a little side note about, I so get you, Jesus, that you need to go off to that quiet place by yourself and take some time. I also think about a t-shirt that I had when I was a kid. And this was a t-shirt that was a hand-me-down from my brother, who I idolized. I had a little bit of brother hero worship going on. Same brother that I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, whose birthday is on April Fool's Day. I only have one brother, so of course it's the same brother. But this t-shirt said, "There are two kinds of people in the world, those from Montana and those who wish they were." And I just thought this was the coolest t-shirt ever. First of all, because it was my brother's and he handed it down to me when it didn't fit anymore. And second of all, because, you know, I'm from Montana. Obviously, Montana is the coolest place ever. And I still think Montana is awesome, even though I don't live there anymore. But, you know, as a however old I was, maybe 10, 11, 12, somewhere in there when he gave me the shirt, I just thought, you know, Montanans were the coolest. I'd never been anywhere else. We'd taken vacations. You know, my uncle lived in Spokane, Washington. So I'd been to Idaho. I'd been to Spokane. I hadn't really been too many places at that point in my life. So how did I know what was better than Montana? But later in life, not that much later, probably, but I began to see similar t-shirts everywhere. You know, we're always dividing people into two groups, you know, us and them. And it's always, you know, there are two types of people in the world, those who love chocolate and those who don't, and those who love coffee and those who don't. And they're often humorously worded. And my favorite one that I've seen more recently says that there are three kinds of people: those who are good at math and those who aren't. And that one just makes me laugh. But we do like to divide ourselves into us and them. And we saw that, of course, in this argument that was going on in the church in Corinth and what Paul was trying to address with his statements to the church in Corinth. I was reading some commentary on this gospel passage, though, that used this idea, you know, of us and them as a way of approaching today's gospel story. There are two kinds of people in the world, those who need help or those who need to help, which, you know, you might be thinking, okay, where's she going with this? But put another way, there are two kinds of people in the world, those who need care or those who need a calling. We can be both kinds of people depending on where we are in our lives. But what kinds of, you know, what kinds of needs do we have at any particular time? And this can even be on a daily basis. Where are you right now? Do you need care or do you need to be caring for someone else? Again, you can be the same. You can be both in the same day. Do you need help or do you have a desire to, do you need help or do you have a desire to help someone else? Do you need care or are you feeling a calling to care for someone else? Again, you can be both in the same day. If I ask the same question every week, I know I would get different answers because we all go back and forth on these things. We see varieties of these scenarios in today's gospel reading from Mark. It's been, as I said, quite a day for Jesus. I understand why he needs to go have some time alone. Remember, he's still at the beginning of his ministry. This is chapter one in Mark, and Mark is a gospel in a hurry. In chapter one and the other gospels, we're still just getting started. We maybe haven't even finished the birth story in these other gospels, but in Mark, he's already been baptized. He's gone to the wilderness. He's started his ministry. He's called some disciples. And we're in the first chapter, so Mark's gospel is definitely in a hurry. But Jesus is really just getting started in the public aspect of his ministry. So right before today's verses, in the text that was read last week, Jesus has been teaching and preaching to great acclaim in a synagogue in Capernaum. And while he was teaching, he healed a man who was possessed of an unclean spirit. Now, today's text takes place right after that scene in the synagogue, when Jesus then goes to the home of Simon and Andrew, where he finds out that Simon's mother-in-law is sick. Jesus heals her, and then when word gets out, he has to heal a whole bunch of people who are then gathered around. They've heard what he can do, first in the synagogue, then with Simon's mother-in-law, and now Jesus is, you know, as so often happens, being swarmed by people who want similar attention from him, who need care from him. It's no wonder then that Jesus does need to take that time to go find a quiet place to rest and to pray before he takes his ministry on the road, so to speak, before his ministry expands from what it has been, before he goes out into the world to preach, to teach, and to heal. And I do have to admit that I'm always intrigued by Simon's mother-in-law in this text because she really is, you know, she's one of those unnamed women in the Bible and we don't really know much about her. I mean, she has no name beyond the fact that she is Simon's mother-in-law. We don't see her before this, before these verses. We don't hear anything from her or about her after these verses. We just know that that Jesus and his disciples go to the home of Simon and Andrew after Jesus has been healing, and he is told that Simon's mother-in-law is sick with a fever. And it can be easy to dismiss this story as one of gender stereotypes because, you know, every time I read that line where Jesus heals her and she immediately gets up and begins to serve them. Yeah, well, that's just, you know, that we can get caught up on that fact, or we can see that there's some other interesting points to her very brief story. First, Jesus heals her simply by taking her hand and raising her up. He doesn't speak any words to her. He simply takes her hand. And in this action, we can see both Jesus's tenderness and his power. The Greek word that Mark uses for raising up is used in connection with healing at a couple of different points in Mark's gospel. Significantly, though, it's also used to describe what happens to Jesus at Easter, at the resurrection. This verb in Greek implies that new strength is given to those who are healed, to those who have been incapacitated by illness. Their new strength then enables them to rise up and take their place in the world. And unfortunately, however you want to look at it, however you feel about it, Simon's mother-in-law's place was to be a servant, to, you know, be a hostess, to make sure that the people who are guests in her house are taken care of. So she is given new strength. She is raised up from her sickbed, and she immediately takes on her role of caring for others and making sure that they have what they need. So without resorting to gender stereotypes, what does Simon's mother-in-law tell us? We can look at her story as more than just a recounting of her being cured of a fever. She's being healed and not only restored to her health, but also restored to her calling. Illness at this time came with a heavy social cost. Not only was the person who was sick unable to earn a living or contribute to the well-being of the household, but their ability to take their proper role in their community, to be honored as valuable members of a household, of a town, of a village, would be taken from them because they're sick and they cannot fulfill the role to which they have been called. So Simon's mother-in-law gives us an example of this. It was her calling during this time and this culture in which she lived to show hospitality, as I said, to guests in her home. When she was sick with this fever, when she was unable to get out of bed, she was cut off from that role, a role that had helped to integrate her into the world surrounding her. And you can think of it this way. When she's in bed sick with this fever, she's literally cut off. She is, you know, she probably doesn't have a room to herself, but she's cut off from social interactions. Even above and beyond being able to be a hostess, she's cut off from social interactions. She's cut off from her community because she is sick and she can't do those things that she's used to doing. She cannot get up and go out even and speak to her friends because she's sick with this fever. So Jesus not only heals her, but he brings her back into the social world. He heals this woman who has no name, and he heals so many others. But more than that, these examples of healing are also examples of people who are being restored to community. They're being restored to their calling because they are restored to the life surrounding the ones who are healed. The ones who are healed are being restored. Excuse me, that was a very awkward sentence. You see this so many times in healing stories. What happens? They are able to rejoin community. The most obvious would be the lepers who are so very, very, very cut off from community. But all of the healing stories have this element of joy, not only at being healed, but being able to rejoin society as this whole restored person who now has a place in that society from which they've been cut off so long by their illness. So first, Simon's mother-in-law was the one who needed help. But once she is healed, then she was able to help. Maybe she even needed to help. She needed to fulfill that role. The verb used to describe her serving is the same verb that Jesus uses to describe his own ministry. It's the way that Simon's mother-in-law maybe does ministry in her own context. We all know people, my grandmother included, who showed love by feeding. You know, by feeding you, by being the perfect hostess, whatever that looked like. So as such, Simon's mother-in-law, who we just get a very, very brief description of, she doesn't even get a name. She's the first person in Mark's gospel to show true discipleship. And as a side note, it should be noted that the word that is used here for her serving and the one that Jesus uses to describe his own ministry is never used of the actual called disciples, those disciples that travel with Jesus. Those disciples just don't get it most of the time. But here it's being used, the word that's used for Jesus' own ministry is used to describe Simon's mother-in-law. I love that. We're going to take our final break of the podcast, and when we come back, we'll finish up talking about this gospel and finish up these texts for the fifth Sunday after Epiphany. Stay tuned. You are listening to the GSMC Bible Study Podcast, and I'll be right back.
Golden State Media Concepts bring you Book Review Podcast, a haven for bookworms of all ages and the widest genres, from mystery to memoirs, romance to comedy, fantasy to sci-fi. If you love to read, this is the podcast for you. It's the Golden State Media Concepts Book Review Podcast.
Welcome back to the GSMC Bible Study Podcast. We are finishing up talking about the text assigned for the fifth Sunday after Epiphany. And I actually want to tie in this text that we are reading from the Gospel of Mark back to the 1 Corinthians text, because I think that they both speak about community. And the verses, of course, in 1 Corinthians just kind of dropped us right into the middle of that correspondence. So we talked more about the context of those verses. And Paul's letters, of course, were always written to address specific issues, to try to encourage the churches to whom he was writing to do whatever it took to make sure that the community would remain intact, to make sure that their faith would continue to bind them together. And Paul sees himself as one of this group, who is called to serve, who is called to care. As I said, I've always been uncomfortable with that part where he says he's all things to all people, because, you know, no pressure there, right, for the rest of us. And I've struggled with that text, but I really liked the commentary that we talked about before when we were talking about 1 Corinthians. So I've struggled with this text, as I said, but I think, again, Paul is talking about more than mere assimilation. He's describing a way of life where he walks alongside all kinds of people in order to tell them about his experiences with God. And I was mentioning that before. So those who are weak in faith don't always understand that idols are powerless, that eating this food doesn't necessarily mean that they've given up their own faith. There are many things that in this world that really shouldn't have an effect on our faith, and yet they can have an effect for people's faith. So when Paul says he becomes weak, he means that he enters into that person's reality to try and help them to serve, or to help them to understand, so that he can feel what they are feeling, so that he can see what effect their beliefs are having on their faith. So he enters into that world, as we were talking about. Paul's words remind us that whether we are living in a group that needs help or the group that feels called to serve, still a huge part of faith life is community. No community is perfect, of course, and no community of faith will ever match us with a group of people just like us. You're never going to find a congregation that is 100% made up of people who look, think, act, behave just exactly like you. Sorry, unless you learn how to clone yourself, and even then, I don't think that's going to work. So no community is perfect. There's always going to be differences. There's always going to be conflict. There's always going to be disagreements. But when we help each other and we allow ourselves to be helped, back to that, you know, the need to help, the need to be helped dichotomy, when we allow ourselves to walk alongside those who are different from us, then our experiences can enrich all of us and draw us as individuals and as a community closer to God. And so Paul recognizes that in order to help or be helped, we have to walk alongside one another. We have to try to understand those differences so that we can all be a part of a stronger community. And that's really what Jesus does so well and so often in the Gospels. He walks alongside people. He hears their stories. He listens to their needs. He is called to serve, to go out into the world and minister. And then those people are so often overjoyed with their healing that in Simon's mother-in-law, she gets up and begins to be a hostess. In some cases, the healed person goes out and immediately begins telling everyone what has happened to them, who healed them, what happened, how it happened, who Jesus is. Jesus' story is spread. That is when they are being called. First, they needed to be helped, and now they are needing to be in service to the one who has healed them. They are being called to help other people as they have helped, even if it's just by telling them their own story. Jesus' calling in Mark's gospel is to share the inbreaking of God's kingdom through healing, through teaching, and through proclamation. The coming kingdom of God could be seen as a terrifying prospect, and it's often described that way in the gospels and elsewhere in the Bible. But it is, in fact, good news. Jesus shows us over and over again that God's power serves the people. And this inbreaking of God's kingdom really is God's love, that little tiny bit of the perfection of God's kingdom breaking into our broken world. Jesus shows this over and over again. From the very beginning of his ministry, Jesus casts out those spirits who are opposed to God's people, to God's word, to God's love, and heals those people who are in need of restoration to their community, who are in need of being able to serve as they have been called to serve. And so back to that t-shirt that I loved. There are two kinds of people in this world. Not necessarily those from Montana and those who aren't, but those who are in need of care and those who are in need of a calling, an invitation to live into the kingdom of God in the world around them. At any given moment, of course, we can be both of these people. And sometimes we can be either of these people, and sometimes we're both of these people. It just depends on the moment. But through Jesus, God comes to restore and to save. God comes to restore us to our place in the community. Through Jesus, we too are able then to restore and heal others, as well as to be restored and healed. It is a continuous cycle. We're never going to just be one or the other. There are always going to be times in our life when we need to be restored and healed. But when we are, then we are able to pass that on to others, just as they are able to help us. It's this whole cyclical, intertwined process that just keeps growing and building and gaining strength as it moves, I guess. And so as you go into the rest of this week, as you are preparing maybe for the season of Lent, I hope that you too can feel that healing, that you can feel God's restoration, you can feel that you're being restored to the world that you have been called to. And may you then go out and share that healing with others. May you be able to go out and share the work that you've been called to do. So as you're thinking about next week and Lent, and maybe you're thinking of taking on a spiritual practice, maybe you're thinking of fasting from something, what have you been called to do? How can the season of Lent maybe help you to be restored, to be able to serve more effectively in the world? Something to think about as we prepare for Lent. And then Lent, of course, is a very speculative time anyway, and we'll be talking more about that as the season progresses toward Easter. So we're going to wrap things up for this week. We'll be talking about the texts assigned for the fifth Sunday after Epiphany. Thank you so much for joining me. Join me again on Sunday when we will talk about the text assigned for next week, the sixth Sunday after Epiphany. In the meantime, you can find all of our podcasts at www.gsmcpodcast.com. You can download those podcasts on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Google Play, any app that you use for your mobile device. And you can follow us on social media. And those links are in the show notes in the description of this episode. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram. We also have a blog. So come check us out on social media. Thank you again for joining me. I hope that the rest of your week goes wonderfully well. But more importantly than that, I hope that you are able and always remember that you are a beautiful and beloved child of God. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Golden State Media Concepts Bible Study Podcast, part of the Golden State Media Concepts Podcast Network. You can find this show and others like it at www.gsmcpodcast.com. Download our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play. Just type in GSMC to find all the shows from the Golden State Media Concepts Podcast Network, from movies to music, from sports to entertainment, and even weird news. You can also follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. Thank you, and we hope you have enjoyed today's program.